Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
From the previous class, I didn't make an introductory lesson. It usually has a low percentage of successful completion anyway, as far as being prepared. But I thought I would provide some reading material just in case, the sermon doesn't go too well this morning. You'll have something that maybe you can fall back on and read. No, I'm just kidding. No, I'm not. But anyway, there is some extra information in there just specifically on the role of prophecy, which will just reveal a little bit about the underlying purpose for prophecy, whether it's short-term, medium range, or even long range, which would be like our messianic prophecies, that kind of thing. So there's a little bit of extra material in there for you. Now, this isn't a continuation of the previous class, but it kind of is. Because what we did last segment is we went through the kings of Israel and those prophets associated with the northern kingdom. And what we're going to do this segment is we're going to look at the Judah kingdom and those prophets associated with those specific kings. And what's interesting, and this is also in the reading material, is that when we look at the authors of Kings and we look at the author of Chronicles, they have a different mission. They have a different plan. It's not just a historical biography of the kings, that they actually have a lesson in mind. And when you read the entirety of these four books, what you're getting is you're getting the information necessary for a country to rebuild itself. And so when you have Ezra and Nehemiah leading the people to reestablish their country after Cyrus said, "Go back, build the house of the Lord." They needed help. They didn't grow up in these times that led to their exile and then ultimately led to them returning. They would only have had their oral traditions of why they were where they were at. Can you imagine being in a prosperous country, successful, everything's going great, and then mom and dad said, "Hey, we got to go back to this desolate place. It has no economy, it has no borders, it has no infrastructure, it has nothing." And they're saying, go back to this place that I didn't grow up in, I have no history, and say, "We've got to rebuild what God had planned for us from the very beginning, this promised land." What would help motivate them? What would help them through their adversity trying to rebuild this? And that's what this story does, is it helps the people understand who God is, and I think that's going to be our message here in a minute, who God is, and then who they are supposed to be in relation to Him. So I have a theme verse here, and it's found in 2 Chronicles 15 and verse 2. And it's concerning King Asa, this particular text. And it says, "And he went out to meet Asa," and that is a prophet. A prophet's coming out to meet Asa. "And said to him, 'Hear me, Asa, and all Judah and Benjamin.'" You see, it's more than just the king, because the king represents the nation as a whole, because he's the shepherd. He's the shepherd over all of the people to ensure that God's will happens. That's his role. And so the people are just as much involved in this as the king and as the prophet. Because even near the end of this study, we're going to look at Jeremiah. And Jeremiah is going to kind of tell God, "You can't punish the people because of the prophets or the kings. You know, it's their fault." And God said, "But they listened to him." They had a choice also, because it was an individual responsibility. "The Lord is with you." Here's the message. Here's the prophetic message. "The Lord, Jehovah, is with you while you are with him." If you seek him, he will be found by you. Isn't that a wonderful message? That when you're having this sense of isolation and separation, and you feel like maybe God is not listening, there is a metric that can tell us that God is with us. He is with us if we are with him. If our goal is seeking diligently him, there's that confidence, that assurance, the promise is that he will be found by you. This is the exact same promise that David will charge Solomon. He'll charge Solomon with this, that if you're with the Lord, he will be with you. But if you forsake him, he will forsake you. And so there's another thing that we're going to explore with this covenant relationship. We're going to emphasize this a lot through these classes, is to answer this question. What does it mean that the Lord forsakes you? What does that really mean? I mean, when you just misbehave, God just turns around and walks off and says, I'm done with you, and that's it. Because isn't that how we see church discipline and how we see home discipline? That when people start misbehaving, it's just, it looks like it's out of control. Well, you know, scriptures say, I wash my hands of you and I move on, because that's what the Lord does. He opens up the earth and he swallows people. And so that's what we're going to do. We're just going to walk away. We're going to pass judgment and it's over. I think there is a startling difference of what this really means. And I think it's evident in the relationship of the kings with their God, with the whole nation as a whole, with their God. And the fact that God is sending these prophets amongst the people, even into the very courts of the king, where we've got men like Jeremiah, who's fearing for his life, going before Jehoiakim, who could die in the process because he was a prophet killer, to bring the message of God's word that God desires covenant. He desires fellowship with his people. And that when they misbehave, he works to correct that. So here's our class schedule. And I think this is how this will work out. I don't know if these dates will change. But I've got three classes that are highlighted here that we would like to assign teachers for. And so I'm looking for volunteers to teach either Joel and Micah, Isaiah, or Zephaniah. And there'll be some lesson material that'll help give you some sense of direction on that. But I don't need a show of hands this morning, because I know you've got to digest this a little bit. But kind of let me know maybe by Wednesday if you want to teach. Otherwise, it's going to fall to Grant to do all three of those.
Yeah, so someone better volunteer.
Yeah. Somebody's going to teach Isaiah in 45 minutes.
Well, here's the deal.
It's clearly an overview.
Yeah. Yeah, and not so much an overview, but as it pertains to Isaiah's relationship to the kings, specifically their role, their message, their relationship with these kings, the prophets and kings. Why was this recorded? And I think it's going to come down to this covenant relationship.
It's not so much you're trying to teach the whole book of Isaiah. Right, you're trying to highlight things about who Isaiah or Zephaniah or these people were in relationship to the kings, right?
That's right.
If the class is the kings and the prophets of Judah, we want to relate those prophets to the kings.
Absolutely.
And the areas in which they...
Yeah, it's a very narrow study, which I think will be extremely beneficial. And so there's our key thought there. And so what God desires is a covenant relationship. And so this is David's charge to Solomon. And it's interesting that he uses the exact same phrase. And you have to think, where did he get this? He no doubt got this concept, this idea from God. And so he says to Solomon, if you seek him, He will be found by you, but if you forsake him, he will cast you off forever. And so he adds that little forever phrase, and that's an interesting word that's repeated quite a bit in Chronicles, which I don't think it has necessarily the meaning that it's stating here, because it just seems like, well, if you just make a mistake, it's over, and I don't think that's really the case. One of the things that he says concerning Solomon, and what is recorded here was really intended for all the kings. This just wasn't for Solomon. But this was to be a perpetual kingdom, and that all of these kings needed to be like Solomon. They all needed to be like David, because David becomes the bar that's set for them all to be like him. And so he tells his son Solomon, know the God of your father and serve him with a loyal heart and with a willing mind. And so there's your exhortation. Here's what you need to do, Solomon. Here's what kings need to do. Here's what leaders in their home need to do. Here's what leaders in the church need to be doing. This is their main goal, to know God. To know God. And that's going to end up being one of our class goals. Okay. And so we have what brings us at the center of the southern kingdom is the fact that the temple is there. And what is so special and unique about the temple being amongst the southern kingdom? What's the number one most important aspect of the temple? What does the temple represent?
God's presence.
Yes, God's presence. And so what we're going to see, even as early as Rehoboam, we're going to start seeing people from the northern kingdom moving to the southern kingdom because the temple is there. These are loyal people to God, and they want to be close to God. And so they're going to find themselves where God is. And so what we're going to have this segment is we're going to have a study of the Lord of the Covenant, the law of the covenant, and the people of the covenant. These are the things that we're going to try to emphasize as we look specifically at these kings and their relationship with God. So here's some class goals. The first one is to define covenant. We're going to attempt to kind of do that a little bit this morning. But really what I hope we see is we look at each of these kings, that we begin to see more and more what it means to be in covenant with God. It's very much different than the concept that we have today of covenants or contracts, agreements that are similar. But we want to define covenant as illustrated by the role of the prophets and their interaction in the lives of the kings of Judah and be able to state the evidence of covenant keeping. What does that look like? To be a covenant keeper. The next is to explain what characterizes effective leadership and how it can be developed and expounded. And specifically, what I mean is spiritual leadership. This is spiritual leadership in the home, spiritual leadership in the church, in our community, where we are effective in our any role of leadership that we might have, whether it's a parent or whether it's in a larger community. We're going to list examples of God's apparent forsaking. And this is going to kind of get us to be thinking about what does God mean when he says, I will forsake you? What does that actually mean? And explain how God's mercy and justice work to foster covenant keeping. Because God's going to make some statements. He's going to say, if you do not obey me, I will abandon you. And then we see kings actually do that. We see the people actually do that. But then the people repent. Like in the case of Jeroboam, we're going to learn he humbles himself. And as a result of humbling himself, God is going to spare him from Shishak. He's not going to bring this full judgment that he was going to impose on Jerusalem. And so God relents. He doesn't do that. And so we'll see that this apparent forsaking produces humility. And it should produce humility in the right heart. And as a result, it should foster covenant keeping. Now, this is one that I thought about as I was typing. I go, if Marty is in this class, he is not going to like this objective, because these are real specific in giving us tangible things to achieve. This last one is not. This is the one that... but I can't help but think this is why we're learning these things in this class. To know and understand God. Just like David told Solomon, I want you to know God. And we can know God through the study of these kings and prophets. To understand God more deeply and have a greater awareness of His abiding presence in our lives. Because we're going to... Maybe the last 24 months, it's maybe felt like God hasn't been as close to you as you think He should be. Well, when we learn His nature, when we learn who He is, He's probably there the whole time. And that maybe what isolation or separation we felt was really on us. And maybe not having a better understanding of who He is. So these are four things I hope that we can try to accomplish. That we ought to be able to do by the end of this class. Maybe we'll come back to it at the very, very end. Okay, covenant versus contract. I know y'all have seen this before, and I'm going to show this to you again. So, there's a difference, I think, between contracts and the biblical view of covenant. And so, think about what are contracts you signed? Can you list me a contract that you've signed? You being a party, and there's another party, and there's signatures on there, and they're agreeing to their side of this agreement, and you're agreeing to your side of this agreement. Can you think of contracts that you've signed? Mortgage. What would be one?
Mortgage.
A mortgage, yep. Because the lender is saying, I'm going to loan you this money, because it's called a promissory note, and what you're agreeing to is that you're going to make this payment for this term of the loan, and when you complete that, then you've completed your obligation to the contract. What was another one?
Your job.
You know, Bill Caudle did not make me sign a contract. I'll have to ask him about that. But yeah, you might expound on that.
If I do my work, you're going to pay me X amount of money.
Okay. Good.
I will show up every day.
So if you don't meet like some of the requirements, it may end in termination or some kind of disciplinary. Yeah, good. Anything else?
Car repair estimate.
Car repair estimate.
They're going to write something before you sign it. You say that you agree to this amount of money to pay.
Sure. And they always come back with more. Yeah. That's right. So, yeah, and we've done this. We've done it with car loans. We've done it with credit cards. You know, you notice a lot of these are financial, where it involves money. Because the reason why many contracts are made, even in our business, when we're trying to sell equipment, Bill's been doing this 50 years, and so he just does it on a handshake. You know, his word is golden, according to him. You know, if he says he's going to do something, he stands behind it. He's a man of his word. Most Christians should be that way. But in business, not all people are that way. So these contracts are written by lawyers intended to do two primary things, even though they probably do a whole lot more. Two primary things is they protect personal rights. So the bank is protecting themselves in the event. So if you can't put more than 20% down, then you have to buy PMI, you have to buy that mortgage insurance. In the event you don't pay, the insurance company covers those losses. And so it protects personal rights. It also limits personal responsibility. So if somehow this whole thing falls apart, I'm protected. Somehow I'm not going to be financially damaged or in some other way damaged as a result of the agreement not happening. So if you think about it, contracts are very self-serving. They're very self-serving. But not so with the biblical idea of covenant. It is not. And this is what God has done. God started at the very beginning when he made man and woman. He had a covenant with them. He provided a covenant. This covenant, really what it did, it gave up God's personal rights. Because ultimately, in the end, he would take care of the sin problem. That's what he would do. When man would not fulfill his part of the agreement, God would ultimately fulfill that. God would take full responsibility. We see that in the person of Christ, dying on the cross. He ultimately took full responsibility.
There is a difference. A covenant is applies to you regardless if you agree to the tenets of the...
That's right. Yeah, because the covenant can be enacted without the consent.
The judgment is going to come upon all.
Sure. That's right. But what...
I guess I might disagree with the universal label of self-sacrificing. That is true with Yahweh's covenant.
Mm-hmm.
And it distinguishes that from all other covenants
right.
and contracts. But in general, in those times, if there was a powerful king and a less powerful king that was, you know, conquered or at least mm-hmm. trying to not have a war or something, the powerful king would make a covenant.
Right.
It would be self-serving. It would
right.
say, you keep your tribute up and I won't come smash you. Right.
Right.
But the idea was that the other party they didn't get a choice. This is the agreement. And it had two sides. If you do it right, then I won't hurt you. If you don't do it right, I will hurt you. So it had two possibilities, but in either case, the covenant was still in effect.
Right.
As with a contract, if you default, that ends the contract. Both parties are relieved of the responsibility. In a covenant, and I think this is a key difference, if one party does a certain thing covered in the covenant, then the other one says, and the gods do so to me and more also if I don't do these other things to you.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of the idea. But in the case
yeah.
of Yahweh, it was striking that
yeah.
the covenant, and think about it, where was Israel when the covenant was made? Were they in a faithful relationship with God? No, they were worshiping the gods of Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
And in the process of making the covenant, they built an image. I mean, these were all things where they didn't earn this right. God, you know, beneficial, said, hey, here is the covenant I'm going to make.
Yeah.
And you don't have a choice. And the book of Deuteronomy has a lot of the form of the old, you know, greater the lesser king to it. Now,
mm-hmm.
here's the background. It starts out with the history. And then here's the law, repeating of the regulations. And it ends by saying, and if you don't do it, then here's what will happen to you. If you do it, here's what will happen. So blessings and the cursing at the end. And then a kind of a, you know, here's the future plan. You know, the
right, yeah.
And all that.
Yeah, and we'll see that. We'll even see that among the kings, where the kings, like even with Asa, for example, he's going to make a covenant with Syria. And it's something that, as a result of him doing this, it's going to have some consequences. Because God establishes what covenant should be. Because this is how he deals with his people. This is how he interacts with his people. And so we see examples of men who are not, they're not keeping covenant in the way that God would. And God is asking us to be this type of law keeper as far as how we're in covenant. So if you think about, you know, marriage being a covenant, too often it looks like a contract. Well, if you don't fulfill your end of this agreement, I'm out. And so you're headed into another agreement. That's called divorce. That can happen with our children. Parents can have this invisible contract with their kids, especially when they're, you know, young adults. And, you know, they're at that high school, college age, and the parents just have these rules and expectations of what this kid is going to look like and what they're supposed to be. And as soon as that kid doesn't measure up, well, they're out. It's done. You know, I no longer have fellowship with this child because they're not living up to my expectations. That's not the agreement that God wants us to have with our kids. You know, in most cases, we did not choose our children. They're just there. And they are what they are to the best of our ability in our effort to raise them. And when things aren't working out, when things aren't going the way that we think as a parent, it really falls back to this idea of covenant. What's this look like? What do I do moving forward in maintaining covenant with my child, my adult child? And so it's not as black and white as just saying, well, they have violated my expectations and therefore they're out. There's something different here. And so when we consider the New Testament, when we look at the New Covenant, Covenant of Grace and Mercy, which I would argue the covenant that God makes with these people is grace and mercy. It's as graceful and as merciful as we even see with Christ. Because God is the same, He's unchanging. And what we see, His interactions with men and men, is no different than God would act in the days of Christ or even today. And so I appreciate Marty bringing that up because we will see covenant keeping, but it's kind of been, it's under man's rules where there are, it's dealt with differently. So there's these two ideas that we see that show up in Scripture. And this is kind of something I hope that maybe we can explore the meaning to. And so, again, this goes back to our theme verse with Asa. I think this idea is kind of mentioned in 2 Timothy, where it says, if we endure, we will also reign with Him, reign with Christ. If we disown Him, He will also disown us. If we are faithless, He remains faithful, for He cannot disown Himself. And so I hope as we work through this, we can kind of work through and say, well, what does this really mean? You know, so in Matthew chapter 10, you know, Jesus is going to talk about this. Well, you know, if you deny me before men, I'll deny you before my Father. Well, what does that mean? What does that look like? So, if I'm in a position where just, I'm amongst a bunch of secular-minded people and they're down in Christ and I don't say anything and I kind of just cower back, but you know what, I'm not getting involved, I don't want an argument. Is that denying Christ? Am I now going to be denied by Christ in heaven? Is that what that means? So I think we, hopefully through this, we'll kind of see God works with people that make a lot of mistakes. They're going to make a lot of errors. And yet, what is God going to implore? Return to me. Return to me. You know what you need to do to make this right. Make it right. This question was raised in the last class. Why was the kingdom of Israel so easily fractured? Do you remember some of the things we talked about? Why was it that the kingdom was so easily divided from the northern tribes, the 10 northern tribes, to the 2 southern tribes? What made this so easy? So acceptable. And why there wasn't an attempt to really try to unify the nation.
The influence of idolatry had a really corrosive effect on who they were as a nation.
Yeah. Okay.
I wasn't in the last class, but I mean, this is more earthly thinking, but they'd only been unified a short time. I mean, in terms of the longer history, you can count all 80 years of Saul and David's reign, although, you know, David took a while to unify, not even under his rule.
Yeah.
And then before that, it was the judges, which had no centralized control, no identity, no...
Good.
Now, that's earthly thinking, right? They should have been unified by God.
Right.
So when they left that behind, then the Roman political self-centered reasons, and then so Rehoboam was easy to take the animosity of Ephraim, which had existed for hundreds of years.
That's right.
Toward the rest of the nation in a way, and leverage that, over the abuse in that Solomon was exacting from, labor that he was exacting from the tribes.
Right. Good.
Those are earthly reasons. If you listen to NPR, that's what they were. That's how they were.
Well, so a lot of these actually, complement that because that was really the heart of the problem. with them not being able to unify. So you can even go back as early as the 10 spies not being in agreement. And what was the very fault of those 10 spies? Well, they didn't believe God to trust Him. They had a measuring stick that they used to determine their conclusion, and God's measuring stick wasn't big enough. We see a lack of, the idea of the 12 tribes, a lack of tribal cooperation through the period of the judges. They could not get along. They could not work together. Part of this, I think a lot had to do with the acceptance of idolatry. There wasn't this pure national religion to unify them. And so that was a challenge. As Marty mentioned about Ephraim, a lot of the tribal infighting that went on in between the tribes, like Benjamin being considered, they almost wiped it out. Not unified again by a national religion, which was supposed to be the Jehovah worship. Unable to secure borders from neighboring peoples. Again, that kind of goes back to the fact that failed to complete the mission that Joshua had charged them with. They, instead of having, working together to be unified by a theocracy that God was king, they had their tribal governments. They were not interested in working together. And then Saul's regional reign. We saw that when we studied 1 and 2 Samuel, that with the regional reign, there was a lack of unification because he had his own interest. His interest was his people. And outside of chasing David and maybe fighting the Philistines when the Philistines threatened his people, that's when he would act. It just failed to unify all the people. And then we just simply had a nation supporting Absalom and the Sheba rebellions because they just went with what looked the best at the time. They weren't looking at what they should have been rooted in. And that was the word of God being presented by the prophets, in the case of Samuel himself, trying to lead the people to where they were living in according to God's will. So we have a lot of that going on. This right here is the actual, this is all the kings from Solomon all the way to the very last king, Zedekiah. These little circles with numbers represents the number of years that they served as king. I decided to just put some little word associations with each one to kind of, because remember, we're looking at snapshots. Can you imagine when you're going through a photo album and you're looking at a picture? Well, you're looking at that picture and you're seeing all kinds of things going on in that picture because it just invokes so many memories of what's going on in that one snapshot. And what we're doing is we're looking at these snapshots. Some only have a couple of sentences worth of information. Yet, but they're intended to teach us some very valuable lessons. And so, there's a period of time where there's some really bad kings going on. Solomon kind of sets the tone for the type of kings that would be established, and Asa kind of breaks that, being a good king. And then Jehoshaphat is a great king. But then his unification with Ahab is then going to lead to a series of bad leadership because of the idolatry. Joash is going to rise to power with proper influence. Remember, Jehoiada the priest is going to help him because he becomes king as a young child. He's going to get that good influence early on. And then that's going to, because of his fall, that's really going to cause again another breakdown. Then you have Uzzah rising, who looks like just a wonderful guy. He's like a mirror of Solomon in the type of king he is. Then he has this major fall. You think Jotham is going to fall, but he's a really good guy. But then after that, we have a bad king. And then we have one of the best in Hezekiah. And then we have the worst in his son, Manasseh. But that's an interesting story.
Half the time, he's the worst.
Because if you think about it, this is a redeemed man. This is a redeemed man, even though he really brings the most wickedness to the country. And then, his son doesn't last very long. God tends to act pretty quickly with him. But then we have one of the best kings again in Josiah, who was a king in his youth. who brings a lot of reformation and revival, but then his sons are an absolute disaster. And he would have very little influence on these. Now, this one here would be his grandson, but these are his three sons right here. And Zedekiah, to me, is one of the best character studies in this class, because it really shows the struggle of a very young man. Think about it. You look at Joshua and Matthew. Zedekiah was at their age when he was king. And here he is ruling from about age 21, 22 till about 31, 32, 33. He's ruling. He's going to watch his young sons die at the hands of Nebuchadnezzar before his own eyes are blotted out, because he wants that to be the last thing that he ever saw. But you see in Zedekiah this conflict to want to be a covenant keeper for God, and yet this strong, worldly, ungodly, earthly influence of his court. His court trying to persuade him. Think about it. A young man in his 20s who has the prophet Jeremiah, this old man, trying to lead him. You just see Jeremiah put his whole being into Zedekiah, trying to convince him to do the right thing, that God was with him, that God wanted a covenant relationship with Zedekiah. But the peer pressure of the court and of the people and of this ungodly influence was too much for him to bear, and he chose that. And it had terrible, terrible consequences. But again, a lot of lessons we'll learn as we go through these kings, learning what it means to keep covenant with God. It's a really busy chart, but this shows the United Kingdom splitting with Jeroboam and Rehoboam. And this is the study that we're going to look at with the kings of the south. And these are the prophets that are associated with those kings. I want you to know they're kind of grouped. They're kind of grouped at very pivotal times with the kingdom. And it's when the kingdom is either on the verge of apostating or a complete apostate. In the case of Athaliah, that's where, right here, right in this section, that's where they actually built a temple for Baal in Jerusalem. I mean, that's how corrupt Jerusalem had become. And what do you see? You see Obadiah and Joel, the two writing prophets, but you see prophets coming in that role. You're going to see Isaiah, Micah, and Obed at the time. Ahaz wasn't very good, but here you have Hezekiah, where you have this huge potential risk of the kingdom being destroyed from Sennacherib, from the Assyrians. And yet, you've got real strong leadership. You've got strong spiritual leadership that's going to get them through that. Otherwise, this disaster that happens at Zedekiah would have happened under the reign of Hezekiah. But it didn't, because he was keeping covenant with God. And then again, we're going to see a lot of prophets coming in at the time, at the end, at the very end. Primarily, if anything, to help prepare these exiles in their return. Same thing, similar chart, maybe a little easier to see, but these are the particular prophets we're going to be looking at, the ones highlighted yellow in our lesson material, in our study. And so here's the study of the kings and the prophets as far as looking at these three concepts. I'll just kind of quickly burn through this. Lord of the Covenant. Is what we're going to see with him is that God is all sovereign. He secures the outcome of battles. A lot of this text is a lot of these references are going to reveal a lot of these things. Particularly, this is with King Asa when he's got a million man army from Ethiopia coming up, a million man army, and so he says it's nothing for you to help, and so he puts all his trust in the Lord. And God will prevail. But years later, Years later, we learn a really, this is one of the neatest phrases that we'll read in this text. For the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth. God sees all. He's all seen. So there's an aspect of His sovereignty. And yet, King Asa did not believe that about God, because he put his trust in the Syrians to deal with Baasha, king of Israel at that time. And then we see with Jehoshaphat that the fear of the Lord fell on all the nations around them, because Jehoshaphat was doing what was right. God brought peace. He kept all the enemies of Israel or Judah away because of his fear. He fulfills his eternal purposes. We see this specifically where David is reminding that to Solomon, as far as the commitment. This is the covenant message. I will be his father and he shall be my son. That is the summary statement of God's covenant with these kings, that he will be a father to them. And I will establish him in my house and in my kingdom forever, and his throne shall be established forever. He's all powerful. We see that with King Abijah. And I call him, he's the preacher, because he preaches this awesome sermon to Jeroboam. You can't do this. You will not prosper because you fight God himself. And sure enough, even though Abijah's outnumbered, I think 2-1 is the math on this, which we know that's terrible odds for a battle. God is going to have a major slaughter, and Abijah's going to win. We're going to find out that he's holy through all of this. And it's interesting with Uzziah, when he was leprous, it says, indeed, he himself was eager to leave the temple when that leprosy came on him. He saw and experienced the holiness of God. Was eager to leave. God is long-suffering, and so we'll even see with Joram, because of the covenant he had made with David. Joram was a really bad king. He was a cousin of the king of the north, which was Ahab's son. Joram married Ahab's daughter, so really a bad marriage, bad covenant marriage. Because of the covenant he had made with David, God would not destroy the house of David at this point, because it just looked like this was going to be a train wreck by bringing in this idolatrous influence in the kingdom. God is trustworthy. He prepared his ways before the Lord his God. As far as Jotham was concerned, that's how he was able to become mighty, God fulfilling his promises. He is good and just. We see this, that the leaders of Israel and the king humbled themselves and says the Lord is just. This is because Rehoboam recognized Shishak coming upon them was a result of God's judgment. And yet we'll see that not only is God good and just, but he will be merciful because they humbled themselves. He's worthy of worship. Now, the law of the covenant, what we learn is the law instructs man's ability to experience fellowship with God. And we see that with King Manasseh. Here he is, he's just being an extremely wicked king, but God said, I will no more remove the foot of Israel. This is exactly what God said to David concerning Solomon when the kingdom started. With Solomon. He said, I will not remove the foot of Israel. I have made my place in Jerusalem, and that's where things will be. But if only they will be careful to do that all that I've commanded them. And so we see the aspect of law keeping. And notice he goes back to Moses here. So you can see the establishment of sound doctrine going back to the Mosaic law. The law also instructs man's ability to experience fellowship with man. And this is what Marty was saying about men making covenants with other men and how it was very self-serving. But it wasn't to be so with them. They were supposed to be different. And so we'll see that what they were supposed to do, the law helped them to settle disputes. Where would disputes come? Be people breaking covenant. People not honoring their word. And so this would create a lot of problems. And so Jehoshaphat would appoint, of all things, Levites and priests, head of Israel's families. These are righteous people. To put them in roles of authority, of roles of leadership, to deal with settling disputes
the right way. And if you talk to the elders, they do a lot of that, settling these disputes, but they do it in such a way that they're reminded of God's covenant keeping as opposed to man's covenant keeping. The law directs covenant keepers to proper worship. We see this with Hezekiah. Again, as the king has ordered, notice the king is ordering how things should be done, but it's according to the word of the Lord. It's according to what David had instructed for them to, as far as proper worship. Covenant keeping leads to prosperity. We see this with Hezekiah, that when he did undertake to do the things according to the law and the commandments, God allowed him to prosper. And we see that with Hezekiah. We also see in the opposite, the rejection of the law leads to disaster. And we see that specifically with Rehoboam, that because he was unfaithful to the Lord, Shishak was able to then come and attack. Where was Shishak all this time? Why didn't he attack before? And I think that's a part of that idea that, you know, God is holding back by His grace. He's holding back these things that could harm them. And so when these things happen, we see that lifting, and they're able then to have access and become instruments of God's, I guess that's it. All right. Thanks for putting up with me this morning. Grant will begin us right into this wonderful study of these kings with Rehoboam. Hope you all come back. And thanks for being here this morning.